Have you ever, searched for something online and just gotten results that were technically right but totally missed what you actually meant?
Oh, absolutely. It's a frustrating moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the flip side, that kind of magic feeling when the search engine just gets it, like it knew exactly what you were after.
Yeah, almost anticipates your next thought.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really digging into how search engines evolved from just matching words to actually, well, understanding information.
Exactly. We're drawing from the AI search manual to trace that path from basic keyword stuff to the really smart AI-driven search we use constantly now.
Our mission today is to peel back those layers. By the end of this, you'll hopefully have a much better sense of why some search tactics still work, why others are totally outdated, and what it really takes to be visible today.
It's a fascinating journey, honestly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Going from simple text matching to this incredibly intuitive search we see now, where do we even start this story?
Well, we have to start way back, really. Think the 1960s, 70s. That's the dawn of what we call information retrieval, or IR systems.
Okay, early days.
Very early. Systems like SMART were pioneers. They set up the basic architecture, the core idea being the inverted index.
Inverted index. Sounds technical. What is that, baseline?
Think of it like the index in the back of a textbook, but, for documents.
Yeah.
It maps each important word or term to a list of all the documents where that term appears. That list is called a postings list.
Gotcha, like a big lookup table.
Exactly. And the process was pretty straightforward, almost mechanical. You take the text, break it into words that's tokenizing, then you often stem them, like reducing running and ran to just run,
Right.
and you store where each word appears. So when a query comes in, like best running shoes, the system tokenizes that, finds the list for best running shoes, merges them, and ranks the results using stats. Things like TF-IDF or BM25 were common ways to score relevance.
Okay, statistical matching.
But here's the key limitation.
Yeah.
It was a purely lexical process, word for word.
Meaning.
Meaning if you searched for automobile, you would not find a page that only used the word car. Not unless someone had manually added car as a synonym for automobile in the system.
Wow. Okay, so like searching running shoes might completely miss pages talking about sneakers.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It just didn't understand that they meant the same thing.
So thinking about the early days of, say, SEO, if you wanted to be found, you literally had to use the exact words the search engine was listening for. That feels incredibly rigid now.
It absolutely was. And that rigidity, that mechanical nature, shaped everything for decades. All those early SEO tactics, heavy keyword research, focusing on exact match keywords, optimizing keyword density, they were all direct responses to how these systems worked.
You were speaking the index's language.
You had to. There were attempts to break free, like latent semantic indexing, LSI, back in the 90s. It tried to infer relationships between words.
Right, I remember hearing about LSI keywords.
Yeah, but it was computationally really heavy. Hard to scale effectively back then. Even Google's PageRank, which was revolutionary for authority, didn't solve the core semantic gap. It told you which pages were important, sure, but not necessarily which ones best matched the meaning of your query.
Okay, so lexical search had its limits. What was the next big step?
Well, fast forward to the early 2010s, the web had exploded in size. The sheer volume of information just demanded something smarter, something more meaning aware.
Needed to understand, not just match.
Exactly. And the breakthrough really came from linguistics, actually, an idea called the distributional hypothesis, summed up by J.R. Firth. You shall know a word by the company it keeps.
Okay. Interesting idea. How does that translate to search engines?
The idea was, instead of treating words as isolated symbols, what if we could represent them mathematically as points in a space, a multidimensional space where words used in similar contexts and therefore likely having similar meanings would cluster together?
So car and automobile would be close together in this space.
Precisely. It's a shift from symbolic matching, like finding the exact letters C-A-R, to geometric reasoning, measuring the distance between points. This is the core idea behind embeddings.
Embeddings. Okay, that's a key term.
A very key term. In 2013, Tomas Mikolov and his team at Google introduced Word2Vec. It used neural networks trained on massive amounts of text to learn these vector representations, these embeddings, for words.
And what was so special about Word2Vec?
The results were kind of staggering. It wasn't just that synonyms clustered together. It captured deeper analogical relationships. The famous example everyone uses is vector king, vector man, plus vector woman. The resulting vector would be incredibly close to the vector for queen.
Whoa, okay, hold on. That wasn't programmed in. The system learned that relationship.
Exactly. It learned it just by observing how those words were used across billions of sentences. No human programmed the king is to man as queen is to woman rule. It just emerged from the patterns in the data.
Okay, that is really interesting. So the machine is starting to understand meaning on its own. What did this mean for how search actually worked? How did retrieval systems use these embeddings?
It changed things significantly. Retrieval systems started using embeddings in a couple of main ways. First, for query expansion. If you searched for running shoes, the system could look at the embedding for that phrase and dynamically pull in terms that were close in the vector space, like sneakers or trainers.
Ah, so automatically finding synonyms based on meaning.
Right. And second, it introduced dense ranking signals. You could represent both the query and the documents as vectors in the same space. Then you could calculate the relevance based on how close those vectors were, often using something called cosine similarity. This semantic score could then be combined with the traditional lexical scores.
So a hybrid approach, lexical matching plus this new meaning-based score.
Often, yes, especially early on. And the idea quickly scaled up. You had Doc2Vec for whole documents, then later models like the Universal Sentence Encoder, USE, and Sentence BERT, Expert, which got really good at creating embeddings for sentences and paragraphs.
So you could embed everything, words, sentences, documents.
Pretty much. The goal became embedding every document in the index as a vector. Then you could do a nearest neighbor search, find the documents whose embeddings are closest to the query embedding. In practice, you might still use the lexical engine to get a first cut, say the top 1,000 results, and then use these more computationally intensive neural models to re-rank those candidates based on deeper semantic understanding.
And the impact on SEO.
Oh, it was a huge shift. The tectonic shift, really. Suddenly, your content could rank for queries that didn't even contain your exact keywords, as long as the meaning was right.
Right. So keyword stuffing started to lose its power.
Exactly. Its mechanical advantage really diminished. The game was moving away from just matching terms to matching meaning.
Okay, so embeddings are understanding words and documents better. But you mentioned Google took this further.
Yes. By the mid-2010s, Google realized, if you can represent words and documents as vectors, why stop there?
Yeah.
Their big leap was aiming to embed everything they cared about in the search ecosystem, create a unified semantic framework.
Everything. Like, what if everything is a vector, what else can Google represent and connect in this way? What's the bigger picture here?
It gets really powerful. Once you can turn anything into a vector, you can measure relationships that were completely invisible before. It basically applies across four key areas that Google deeply cares about.
Okay, what are they?
First, websites or domains. Google creates domain-level embeddings that capture the overall topical focus and authority of a site.
So my website has its own vector. Sort of, yes. Imagine a site that consistently publishes really deep, expert reviews on trail running gear. Over time, it builds a strong signal, a dense cluster of meaning in the endurance sports equipment part of this huge vector space. When a query related to that topic comes in, the system can see that this domain's embedding is semantically very close and might prioritize it.
Ah, so that's why topical authority and content depth matter so much. You're basically training your domain's embedding.
Exactly right. You're defining your neighborhood in the embedding space.
Yeah.
Second area, authors.
Individual people.
Yep. Google builds embeddings for authors based on bylines, structured data about them, where else they publish. These vectors represent their expertise, their reliability. It connects directly to EEAT, experience, expertise, authoritativeness, trustworthiness.
So an author known for writing about, say, cardiac surgery develops an embedding related to that. Precisely. And if they consistently write high-quality content in that area, their author embedding becomes a strong signal. For you, this means consistent authorship, having clear author pages, building credibility across the web. It all feeds into this.
Okay, websites, authors, what's third?
Third, entities. Think of everything in Google's knowledge graph, people, places, organizations, concepts. Each one gets an embedding.
Like the Eiffel Tower.
Exactly. And its embedding connects it not just to Paris in English, but potentially to Iron Tower in Japanese, or to images of it, or to other landmarks with similar architectural styles. It works across languages and modalities.
Wow. So connecting things based on real-world relationships, not just text.
That's the power of entity-based search fueled by embeddings. For you, this underlines why things like schema markup Covering relevant entities in your content and linking to authoritative sources are so important. You're helping Google connect your content to the right nodes in this giant graph.
Okay, websites, authors, entities, what's the fourth?
The fourth, and arguably the most powerful and maybe the most opaque, is users.
Google creates embeddings for us.
Essentially, yes. Based on your search history, the links you click, how long you stay on a page, your location, all that behavior builds a kind of fingerprint, a user embedding.
How does that work in practice?
Think of the classic Jaguar example. If you search for Jaguar, does that mean the car, the animal, or the sports team? Your user embedding, reflecting your past behavior and interests, helps Google disambiguate and personalize the results. It re-ranks the potential candidates based on your likely intent.
So personalization goes way beyond just location.
Way beyond. And it means that, realistically, no two users are seeing the exact same results, especially in generative outputs. So for content creators, you need content that's robust enough to be useful for different user intents and contexts.
Okay, that's a lot. Embeddings for everything. But even with that, there were still limits, right?
Yes. Even with embeddings, the underlying architecture of many systems had limitations, especially before 2017. Models like RNNs or LSTMs process text sequentially, word by word, essentially.
Like reading a sentence one word at a time.
Exactly. Which makes it hard to capture long-range context, how a word at the beginning of a paragraph relates to one at the end. And it wasn't very efficient for parallel processing on modern hardware.
So what changed?
The huge breakthrough came in June 2017. A paper from Google titled, "Attention is All You Need." It introduced the transformer architecture.
Transformers. Heard a lot about those.
You definitely have. They completely changed the game. Instead of sequential processing, transformers use a mechanism called self-attention.
Self-attention.
Yeah. In simple terms, it allows every word or token in a sentence or paragraph to look at every other token simultaneously. It figures out which other words are most important for understanding the meaning of the current word, no matter how far away they are.
So it sees the whole context at once.
Effectively, yes. And crucially, this process is highly parallelizable. You can process all the words much more quickly on modern chips like GPUs and TPUs. This meant you could train much larger models on much more data, much faster.
Okay, faster and better context. What did that mean for search for information retrieval?
It was revolutionary for understanding complex queries and documents. Transformers could grasp those long-range dependencies. A query like, "What is the fastest animal on land?" could be correctly linked to a passage about cheetahs, even if the word cheetah appeared much earlier or later in the document. Far away from the phrase, "fastest animal," the context wasn't lost.
Okay, here's where it really clicked for me when I was reading about this. Instead of that word-by-word reading, the system suddenly sees the whole picture, the whole sentence, the whole paragraph all at once. It can make these incredibly rich connections. So what did this mean for Google specifically?
Well, the most immediate and impactful application came in late 2018 with BERT, Bidirectional Encoder Representations from Transformers.
BERT, another big name.
A huge one. BERT took the transformer architecture and trained it bidirectionally. That means when figuring out the meaning of a word, it looked at the context both before and after it, simultaneously.
Unlike older models that maybe just looked left to right.
Exactly. So the embeddings BERT produced were deeply contextual. The vector for the word bank in the phrase riverbank would be completely different from the vector for bank in bank account.
Ah, okay. It understood the different meanings based on the surrounding words.
Precisely. And in Google search, this meant a massive improvement in understanding the nuances of queries, especially conversational ones. It got much better at passage-level understanding, finding the exact snippet within a long page that answered your question, even if the wording wasn't identical.
So better featured snippets, better direct answers.
Better snippets, better ranking overall because it could more accurately judge the relevance of a passage to the query's intent. BERT was also used to refine the ranking itself, sometimes by re-encoding the query and a potential result together to get an even more precise measure of semantic fit.
And this paved the way for generative models too, right? Like GPT.
Absolutely. BERT was primarily an encoder great for understanding. The GPT family focused more on the decoder part of the transformer, becoming incredibly good at generating text. This autoregressive generation, combined with the understanding from encoders and retrieval techniques, what we now call retrieval augmented generation, or RAG, is what powers a lot of the AI overviews and generative search experiences we're seeing today.
Okay, so transformers and BERT brought contextual understanding. What came next? Was there another big leap?
There was. In 2021, Google announced MUM, the Multitask Unified Model. They initially positioned it as like 1,000 times more powerful than BERT, but the real significance wasn't just raw power, it was its scope.
Scope? How so?
MUM was designed from the ground up to be multimodal, multi-tag, and multilingual.
Okay, break that down. Multimodal.
Multimodal means it breaks down the walls between different types of information, text, images, audio, video. It's trained on all of them together.
So it understands images and text in relation to each other.
Yes. Imagine you search for, can I hike Mount Fuji with these boots? And you include a picture of your hiking boots. MUM could potentially understand the question, analyze the image of the boots, and retrieve information from travel blogs, gear reviews, maybe even video reviews, photos of the trail conditions, and synthesize an answer.
Wow. Okay, so things like image alt, text, video transcripts, they become much more important.
Absolutely. They become first-class citizens for the AI to understand and potentially include in its generated answers. That's multimodal. Then there's multitask.
Multitask.
This means MUM can handle lots of different tasks within one model information retrieval. Classifying information, summarizing it, translating it, even performing some level of reasoning, all more efficiently than having separate models for each task.
So it could compare information from different sources more easily.
Right. Like comparing, say, trail conditions on Mount Fuji in October versus Mount Rainier in May. Mm-hmm. It could retrieve data, maybe translate some reports from Japanese, classify the sources, give you a comparative summary.
Okay. And the last one, multilingual.
Yeah, this is huge. MUM was trained across more than 75 languages simultaneously. This allows for true cross-lingual information retrieval.
Meaning
you could search in English about, say, hiking in the Dolomites, and MUM could find a super relevant recent review written in Italian by a local mountain guide, understand it, and potentially incorporate that information into your answer, even if it hasn't been translated into English yet.
Whoa. So content in any language could suddenly become relevant to my search.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
It makes the entire global web of information much more interconnected. Content in any language can become a competitive asset or even a threat if your competitors have good content in other languages.
Okay, MUM sounds incredibly powerful, understanding everything in every format across languages. But what about the sheer cost of running something like that? Billions of searches every day. That must be computationally insane.
That is the exact challenge. Making these incredibly sophisticated models work at Google's scale with acceptable speed and cost is a monumental engineering problem. And that's where another key piece comes in, MUV era.
MUV era? What's that?
Think of it as Google's push for efficient multi-vector retrieval. Some of the most nuanced models, like those that represent queries and passages using multiple vectors to capture different aspects, like Colbert, are really good but very expensive to compute similarity for at scale.
Right. More complex means slower and costs more.
Exactly. MUV era is essentially a technique to make this feasible. It uses something called fixed dimensional encoding, or FDE. It's a clever way to take those complex multi-vector representations and compress them down into a single compact vector.
A smaller vector that still captures the important information?
That's the idea. It mathematically approximates the similarity you'd get from the full multi-vector comparison, but it's much faster to work with. Google reported things like 90% lower latency and needing to look at 2 to 5 times fewer candidates during retrieval.
So massive efficiency gains without sacrificing too much accuracy.
Precisely. It allows them to get the benefits of nuanced multi-vector understanding, but apply it efficiently at scale. They use the compact FDEs for the initial broad search to find a small set of likely candidates and then apply the more expensive full comparison just on that small set for the final ranking. It's about balancing precision and scale.
Okay, that makes sense. Speed and accuracy at massive scale.
It's crucial. So if you put it all together, the journey from lexical matching to embeddings capturing meaning to transformers understanding context to MUM handling multimodality and MUV era enabling efficiency, you see this clear trend.
Which is?
In this neural IR era, embeddings are the fundamental building blocks. They're the substrate for everything. How information is found, retrieval, how it's ordered, ranking, how it's tailored to personalization, how answers are generated, synthesis, and even how safety checks are applied. They connect everything in a way a lexical search never could.
So wrapping this all up, what's the big takeaway for us, for anyone listening who's trying to create content or just understand how information is found online now?
I think the most profound shift for you, the listener, is realizing that success isn't just about having the right keywords anymore. It's about occupying the right neighborhoods in this giant multi-dimensional embedding space.
Occupying the right neighborhoods.
Meaning consistently creating valuable content, text, images, video, structured data about entities that strongly aligns semantically with the topics and user intents you want to be associated with. You're constantly shaping how the algorithms perceive your meaning and relevance.
And it's not just about getting found anymore, right, with generative AI.
Exactly. We've moved beyond simple retrieval and ranking to this new stage of negotiating with systems that retrieve information and then synthesize something new. The retrieval layer we've been talking about acts like a gatekeeper. It decides which fragments of information from which sources even get considered for inclusion in that final AI-generated answer.
So it's a different kind of visibility challenge.
It really is. Unlike the old blue links, where you had a rank, generative systems often act more like selective editors. They pull pieces from multiple places, weave them together, and might discard most of what they initially retrieved. Understanding how your content gets interpreted and potentially used in that synthesis process is the new frontier.
What a journey we've covered. Seriously, from basic word matching back in the 60s and 70s, through embeddings, learning meaning, transformers grasping context, MUM understanding everything, and Movera making it run efficiently. It really hammers home that search today is so much more than keywords. It's about deep contextual meaning.
Absolutely. If you think of this discussion as kind of the blueprint of the machine, the next critical step is figuring out how to effectively communicate with that machine, how to influence its interpretation and output. Your content isn't just sitting on the internet. It's being constantly evaluated, compared, embedded, and potentially synthesized within this incredibly complex space.
So here's a final thought for you, the listener, as you go about your day. When you ask a question to an AI-powered search now, remember, you're not just hitting an index of words. You're interacting with this incredibly rich, interconnected web of meaning, a web that in many ways understands you, your context, your likely intent, just as much as it understands the information itself. What does that really mean for how you'll create content or even how you consume information from now on? Thanks so much for joining us for this deep dive into the evolution of search. We really hope it's given you a powerful new way to think about the information landscape all around us.